Yesterday, the Baseball Hall of Fame elected a new class of 17 members, all from the Negro Leagues, and it includes the Hall's first woman. We're also 2 days out from the opening pitch of the first ever World Baseball Classic. It's baseball's version of the World Cup. If you have questions about the new Hall of Fame members or about the Baseball Classic, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or zap us an email to talk@npr.org. Joining us is our baseball pal, Alan Schwartz, senior writer for Baseball America and author of The Numbers Game. He's with us by phone from Port St. Lucie in Florida, where he's attending the New York Mets spring training camp. You trying out, Alan?
Oh, happily no. The Mets are far better than they would need to be to try out the likes of me. Now, 3 or 4 years ago, they did extend me an invitation, but Omar Minaya has really taken care of things.
Okay. Now, these Hall of Fame elections were remarkable. This was sort of the end of a long process of reevaluating people who a lot of historians said were overlooked.
Well, yeah, the Negro Leagues were really, there was a bit of a black hole for a long, long, long time in terms of understanding the history of the Negro Leagues, understanding who were the excellent players. I mean, some were so obvious, like Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige and several others who have been in the Hall of Fame for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a lot of time spent or there wasn't a concerted, comprehensive effort to understand everybody who played such a large role in that part of baseball history. And Major League Baseball did help fund a large statistical and otherwise study to better understand who were the great players back then, who should be in Cooperstown with the likes of Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb. And that's why it culminated with the announcement of 17 new Hall of Famers.
The process, as you suggested, was unusual. A committee of 12 met, and you needed 75%, same as always, but 75% to be elected.
Yeah, and I mean, it's an awfully large class, and my first instinct, to be honest with you, was that it was, you know, it's a little too many, because I think that the Hall of Fame has been watered down a little bit by many white inductees. I mean, mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the fact that it's a Negro League special election. But as I actually did the numbers, and when you look at it, the Negro Leagues lasted about 30 years, and the National American League, you know, basically what we think of as the major leagues, has been around since 1876, and the American League since 1901. And so roughly, you know, 3/16 of baseball history was the Negro Leagues. So maybe there should be 3/16 of Hall of Famers, which is what they're getting close to now.
Tell us a little bit about Effa Manley, who's getting most of the publicity in this new class of inductees.
For those who don't realize, Effa Manley was a woman. In fact, you know, there's some question as to her ethnicity. I believe that she was believed to have mixed parents, but then again, there's some belief that they, in fact, were not mixed, that she was indeed white. Nonetheless, she was the co-owner of the Newark Eagles in the Negro Leagues and just played a very large role in demanding respect for the Negro Leagues. It's staggering to think of it today. She actually had an anti-lynching day. I mean, I'm sorry, I have nothing to say to that. But she really spoke up as to the rights of Negro League players and also of Negro League owners, because of course when the major leagues started signing black players, started signing the likes of Jackie Robinson and players from the league, she fought for the teams to be compensated for the loss of their stars. Of course, you know, those efforts only went so far. The Negro Leagues were effectively dead within 5 or 6 years, and they hung around for another 5 or 6. Mm. That they were basically. Their time was done very quickly. But, you know, she was an immensely influential person within that quite misunderstood sphere.
And on her tombstone, I understand it reads, she loved baseball.
Yeah, yeah. There are actually many tombstones like that. There's a former pitcher for the Mets who I did a story on once who he had only one baseball card from 1963, and it said he achieved his dreams with a picture of the baseball card etched into his tombstone. You'd be surprised how many of those there are.
We're talking with Alan Schwartz. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Mary on the line. Mary's calling from Kansas City.
Hi, Neil. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
On the front page paper of the Kansas City Star today, it talked about Buck O'Neill being overlooked. And, you know, he's a hometown hero here, and just was curious about your guest, thoughts on Buck O'Neill being overlooked?
The other living candidate, Minnie Minoso, also did not get voted in. Alan Schwartz?
Well, yeah, I'm glad I could see you choosing your words carefully there, Neil. I guarantee everybody that Buck O'Neill was not overlooked. Buck O'Neill, for those who don't know, was an immensely successful player in the Negro Leagues, was a manager in the Negro Leagues, and became the first African-American coach in Major League Baseball, and then was the unofficial star of the Ken Burns baseball series, telling all sorts of stories, and is arguably the most beloved man living in baseball today. However, I'm sure that this group of voters went to great pains to understand the qualifications of each and every candidate they had. They inducted 17 people. I'm sure they wouldn't have minded inducting 18 or 19, but there must have been a reason that I'm not aware of that they did not select Buck O'Neill. He was obviously a strong candidate, but he just didn't get the votes. But I'm sure he was not overlooked.
Mary, people in Kansas City will dispute that, I'm sure.
Yes, I was just going to say that, Neil. He's our Hall of Famer here. One of many. So.
Well, and let's give him his due. I mean, he also has played an extraordinarily large role in Kansas City in the development of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, Hall of Fame and Museum. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent a day with him down there. He's just a delightful, delightful man. However, of course, let's be fair, the Hall of Fame is not about popularity. It's about one's concrete play and then also contributions to the game. And while, of course, Buck O'Neill did very well in both of those categories, I'm sure that the committee had good reason to not, select him, because clearly they wanted to elect a lot of people.
Mary, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Neil.
Got to move on. Thanks. Got to move on to talk about the World Baseball Classic, which gets underway this Friday, I guess, in Tokyo. And these are national teams, the United States, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Panama. Are the players you're talking to there in spring training, are they excited about this?
Some are and some aren't, to be honest. Most of the ones who aren't playing. They chose not to, which is fine. I mean, this is a little contrived, let's face it. The World Cup in soccer and some of the international competitions that we've seen in hockey and some other sports are almost always the best players, and it is the signature event for that sport. Now, this is something that, like I said, is a little more contrived. It's done for marketing reasons on behalf of Major League Baseball and the Players Association. They're doing their version of a World Cup. Here it is in spring training, so not all of the players are ready, and not all of the players even want to bother playing. And that's okay; that happens. But there are an awful lot of stars who are playing: Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez for the United States, and Albert Pujols and Vladimir Guerrero for the Dominican Republic. The list goes on and on, and I think that is it a perfect tournament? No, but is it going to be a lot of fun? Yeah.
One thing that people have asked questions about, though, is spring training. They're imposing pitch counts on the pitchers so they hurt their arms before the start of, I guess what everybody sees is more important, the real season.
Well, yeah, exactly, and they have to do that because some pitchers, and particularly those from Latin American countries who in general are more fervent about their desire to play than the Americans, because they, the smaller countries, the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Cuba, they really want to knock off the big bad Americans, in a very healthy and competitive way. And, their employers who are paying them guaranteed contracts don't want to have, Frankie Rodriguez throw 70 pitches and blow out his arm for good old Venezuela. I mean, you can't, or Dominican Republic. I mean, you can't afford to let that happen. So you have to have pitch limits, for relievers, for starters, have rest rules where, look, if you pitch 60 pitches one day, you can't come back for another 4 days or whatever it may be.
Whatever it may be, yeah.
They have to do it for insurance reasons and also for the integrity of the Major League season.
Well, a couple of weeks of half pipe and snowboard cross, interesting enough, but hey, end of this week, we get back to real sports, baseball.
That's right.
Alan Schwartz, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Anytime, Neil.
Alan Schwartz, senior writer for Baseball America. He also writes the Keeping Score column for the Sunday New York Times sports section. He's the author of The Numbers Game as well. He joined us by phone from Port St. Lucie in Florida, where he's attending the New York Mets spring training camp. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.